are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Monday, January 14th, 2019. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, author Jack Kelly, on the edge of anarchy, the railroad barons, the Gilded Age, and the greatest labor uprising in America. Also on the program today, government shutdown, now the longest ever, continues to be illegal. But Barr and Wheeler will get hearings this week for Attorney General and EPA Chief. Meanwhile, LA teachers on strike, looking for permanent funding for schools in L.A. Meanwhile, Trump's VA looks to massive privatization. And John Bolton's been seeking Iran bombing options as recently as September. Meanwhile, Trump Adderall tweets threats to Turkey in the middle of the night. And a federal judge saves free birth control provided by the ACA coverage, for now at least. U.S., of course, calling for a new government in Venezuela. No word yet on hidden weapons of mass destruction. And that crowdsourced border wall GoFundMe? Well, it's forced to innovate into a new grift. And Jonathan Chait strikes out again. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. We are all still in the afterglow of the live show that we did yesterday at the Brooklyn Bell House in Brooklyn, New York. 300 and about 70 somewhere between 370 and 400 people came to see us at the Bell House yesterday. It was a great show. John Benjamin stopped by, helped out. For those of you who are at the show, you know that John felt a little bit awkward about coming out in public. I guess it had been a while and had, he had some very, I guess, last minute fixes on his hairline that he was working on. And I am sad. Didn't see that photo. Oh, my God. I didn't see that photo. Did anybody take a photo of the audience? Oh, I forgot to do that. That was a major fail. Well, you see, John's,
follow us on Instagram.
Yeah, there's John's. Yeah, you can check that out on Instagram. I got a text from John later in the evening saying the stuff will not come out. And I have a video. We should actually play this maybe of him over his kitchen sink trying to wash out his head. John really went to the mat on this one.
It looked like some of it he just filled it in with a Sharpie.
Yeah, God knows. I don't know what happened with that.
You can kind of see here, though, that this line above, it's a bit softer, and that's where the hair product is in.
Yes.
It looks better than the one he's mocking, even
right,
still, though.
It's true. We played a great video from the Chris Lopako and Ronald Reagan and Distant Peasant. We had lots of fun. And we should tell you, people have asked if the poster will be available. We still have posters available. We're trying to figure out a way of selling them online because apparently there's new technology that allows you to do that. And we're just trying to figure out the details of that. We will keep you updated. But want to thank everybody who came out, unveiled Ronald Reagan's, what I thought was a banner about, you know, what is it, get the Chuck out. And it turns out, I have been informed by Ronald Reagan that that is actually a shower curtain available on the redirected merch site.
Is there a better deal on shower curtains than on banners?
I don't know. I think he just got really inspired by the shower curtains. So I just a real big thank you to all of you who came out. We will be posting that episode soon. Not sure quite yet. We haven't quite figured out what the how we're going to do that, but we know technically how to do it, just not in terms of like when it's in what context we're going to release it. But we will shortly. I should tell you, you spend one third of your life in sheets. And if you're looking for a New Year's resolution, better sleep is a great place to start. With Brooklinen, you can finally get five-star hotel quality sheets easily and without breaking the bank. Because Brooklinen works directly with their manufacturers, passes the savings on to you. You can mix and match over 20 colors and patterns and explore Brooklinen's collection of towels, robes, sleep masks to add a splash of luxury to your daily routine going into 2019. I've spoken about Brooklinen and my Brooklinen sheets hundreds of times. I have now probably about four or five sets of sheets because I got it for, I keep rolling it in for the kids because you start, at one point you start to feel bad. Like, why am I have such nice sheets and the kids don't? And I sleep better. And didn't you get some Brooklinen sheets?
I did.
Are you loving them?
They're good, yeah. Sean was skeptical as to whether the fancy sheets would be better than sheets that you buy at the dollar store, which is the only kind we'd had up until now. And now we are both in agreement that they are indeed better.
And the other thing is they will last. And the sheets like that, it's like after like a month, they start getting into like their sweet zone. And that lasts about 5 or 6 years, too.
The cats like them.
I mean, the... For me, I go for the that crisp, cool cotton feel. But yeah. There's other options, too. They are the best, most comfortable sheets I've ever slept on. It is now time for your upgrade. Brooklinen.com is giving an exclusive offer for just my listeners. Get $20 off and free shipping when you use the promo code MAJORITY at Brooklinen.com. So confident that their product, that all their sheets, comforters, and towels come with a lifetime warranty. And the only way to get $20 off and free shipping is to use promo code MAJORITY at brooklinen.com. That's Brooklinen, BROOKLINEN.com. Promo code MAJORITY, Brooklinen. These really are the best sheets ever. And folks, speaking of kids, the first thing, well, it wasn't the first thing. It took me a while, but I did it. I was much better when Saul came around. And that is I bought life insurance when I had a kid. Hadn't even thought about it beforehand. Probably should have thought about it when I got married. My wife and I probably at the time should have contemplated that, but waited till I got kids, but I'm glad I did at least then. You can protect your loved ones with the peace of mind of life insurance. Think you can't afford it? Chances are that SelectQuote can help you get it for less than a dollar a day. What SelectQuote does, they comparison shops up to 10 highly rated companies, including Prudential, Banner Life, Mutual of Omaha, and others, my insurance company. I actually have two sets of insurance. Both are included in this crew. I didn't get it through SelectQuote, but the bottom line is it's price. You get quality insurance companies. You can look up these insurance companies online to see, you know, how they're rated. But go in there and you want to get the best price possible. SelectQuote could find a 35-year-old man a $500,000 policy for under $19 a month. That's less than a dollar a day. A cup of coffee costs you more than that. SelectQuote breakthrough technology allows them to quickly match you with the best insurance company to find your best policy. Plus, quotes are free. I am not a financial advisor. I don't know how to advise you. I got term life insurance, and I got it through basically through both kids going through college. So when I had my second kid, I added. First kid was like, I think I did like 20, 30 years. Second kid, I did 20, so that I was covered. But The time to do it is when you're young, too, because apparently as you get older, it gets more expensive. I'm not apparently. That was my experience. But let SelectQuote save you time and money. Get your free quote at SelectQuote.com/majority today. That's SelectQuote.com/majority for your free quote. Don't put off protecting your family for another day. And lastly, you know what's smart? Kicking off 2019 by planning out which roles your business needs to fill and hire for. You know what else is smart? Starting the new year off strong by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority to hire the right people. Unlike other job sites, ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates for you. Its powerful matching technology scans thousands of resumes to identify people with the right skills, education, and experience. Then it actively invites them to apply to your job, so you get qualified candidates fast. That's why ZipRecruiter is rated number one by employers in the U.S. This rating comes from hiring sites on Trustpilot with over 1,000 reviews. Folks, you know what I feel about ZipRecruiter. That's how Brendan is sitting in this office right now. It was...
Clutch.
I remember when I did it. I was like, you know what? They advertised with us. I should try it. And, you know, because I had noodled around before. It looked good. But if you don't, you're not hiring somebody. But I went in. I did I did it at first. And then I put the pedal to the metal with it. And we ended up with Brendan. But there was we got a tremendous amount of really qualified people. Right now, my listeners can try ZipRecruiter for free at this exclusive web address, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. If you love this show, show your support and go to ZipRecruiter by going to ZipRecruiter.com/majority. Zip, ZipRecruiter.com/majority. That's ZipRecruiter.com/majority. ZipRecruiter, it's the smartest way to hire. All right, so this happened, I guess, over the weekend. I'm a little bit confused by having done the show on Sunday. But Donald Trump, there was a couple of pieces in the New York Times that broke over the past couple of days. One is that the FBI had opened an investigation, a counterintelligence investigation. That is different from a criminal investigation. There is no report that's issued from there are no charges that are issued necessarily. I mean, it is one specifically to sort of protect assets. And the Times piece said nothing was found, but I'm not sure if that is conclusive. But leave it at that, at the very least. Also, what broke this week was that Donald Trump went to great lengths, according to the Washington Post, to prevent anybody from getting any type of read about what happened in his meeting with Putin, and literally took the translator's notes.
Private.
You know.
It's private.
Classic stuff you do.
Who are you, Jeff Bezos?
I want those notes.
And, you know, like, I guess it's conceivable that Donald Trump is just such a sophisticated guy that and is trying to do something that is so remarkable that he would, you know, as opposed to like what he said to Duterte or you know, others, that he, you know, was worried about the deep state, you know, particularly that early in his, I mean, you know, because this is a guy who has probably read quite a bit of the history of the machinations of the U.S. government. And probably understood from a bureaucratic standpoint who you want to prevent stuff from getting to, right? I mean, that's not hard to believe.
Total reader.
And well-versed in all of these pitfalls. So at the very least, he's not defensive at all. He went on Jeanine Pirro's show. And Jeanine Pirro, folks, I'm sure most of you know what we mean in the biz by a softball question. Well, here's what happened when someone pitches you a softball and you are so defensive that you whip out a machine gun and try and shoot at it.
Have you ever worked for Russia, Mr. President?
I think it's the most insulting thing I've ever been asked I think it's the most insulting article I've ever had written. And if you read the article, you'd see that they found absolutely nothing. But the headline of that article, it's called The Failing New York Times for a Reason. They've gotten me wrong for 3 years. They've actually gotten me wrong for many years before that. But you look at what's going on. You know, I fired James Comey. I call him Lion James Comey because he's a terrible liar. And he did a terrible job as the FBI director. Look at what happened with Hillary Clinton and the emails and the Hillary Clinton investigation. One of the biggest screw-ups that anybody's ever seen as an investigation. And what happened after I fired him, Andrew McCabe, Peter Strzok, his lover, Lisa Page.
Pause it for 1 second. Right now.
She's so messy. It's His lover, Lisa Page. Janine, we remember that too.
Janine Pirro is sitting there going like, I was joking. I said it as a joke. Did I not communicate that? That's all she's saying right in her head.
Setting like, you up to dunk.
She, like, literally, they've cut away. This is all B-roll because she's got this thing going. I'm convinced at this point she's looking around going, like, what's going on with this guy? Go ahead.
They did it. And, you know, they're all gone. Most of those people, many, many people from the top ranks of the FBI, they've all been fired or they had to leave, and they're all gone. This
he
is what they were talking about. And obviously nothing was found. And I can tell you this, if you ask the folks in Russia, I've been tougher on Russia than anybody else, probably any other president, period. But certainly the last three or four presidents, modern-day presidents, nobody's been as tough as I have from any standpoint, including the fact that we're doing oil like we've never done it. We're setting records in our country with oil and exporting oil and many other things, so which is obviously not great for them because that's where they get their money for the most part. But many other things. So I think it was a great insult, and the New York Times is a disaster as a paper. It's a very horrible thing they said, and they've gone so far that people that weren't necessary believers are now big believers because they said that was a step too far. They really are a disaster of a newspaper.
Well,
and still no actual denial.
Right.
Insulted. I'm so insulted.
It's so funny. I'm listening to this Crimetown podcast about the Kwame Kilpatrick mayoral reign in Detroit, and it all looks like totally nothing compared to this. But one of the things, he's a lot more articulate than Trump, but he always did that, like, I think that question is insulting.
Right.
And I think the fact that you would ask that in front of the people is not only an insult to them and to me, but even you and your job as a journalist.
You've insulted yourself.
On and on and on. And it's like that, except, you know, with also a guy who's losing all of his faculties in his 70s.
And a friendly journalist.
Facilities.
He couldn't see, you know, to be fair, he couldn't see her, right? Because he was just on the phone. Because she's going... She's doing the old laughing, and he apparently was just, you know, this is the thing, is that when you snort Adderall, I think what it does is it makes it much harder to pick up on social cues.
What?
And I think that's probably the problem.
I thought how you treated Robert Durst was totally unfair.
You are not going to be Attorney General now, Janine Pirro. Yeah. So
I was going to make you Attorney General and head of the Space Force, but now nothing. Nothing.
Let's not blame a perfectly good stimulant for Trump's shortcomings, all right? Snorting Adderall is great.
I'm sure that's true, but right. I would not go on.
Are you sure that's true?
If you're very... Well, I'm not sure.
I was going to say.
I mean, I can imagine it's possible, but I think if you're in a very defensive state, I would not go on national cable TV and try and defend yourself.
I'm alone. Pirro's on the line. What does she want? She's my friend. Wait, Russia? She's not my friend anymore.
God.
Hey, Mike.
All right.
That's John, sir. I don't care. By the way, that is the best piece of news that's come out of the White House.
Kevin McCarthy thing?
No, that Trump calls John Bolton Mike. Doesn't know who he is.
Whatever. You look like a Mike.
Mustache Mike.
There's
over
no
here.
Mustache Mike over
There's
here.
There's no way you'd have a mustache like that unless you're in a Mike.
You'd never Folks, be able to succeed in the condo business.
We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking to Jack Kelly on the edge of anarchy, the railroad barons, the Gilded Age, and the greatest labor uprising in America. We'll be right back.
Sculpture at St. Martin's College, that's where I caught her eye. exploded. I said, in that case, I'm gonna ruin Coca-Cola. She said, fine. And then in 30 seconds time, she said, I wanna live like common people. I wanna do whatever common people do. Wanna sleep with common people. I wanna sleep with common people like you. What else could I do? I said, oh, I'll see what I can do. I took her to a supermarket. I don't know why, but I had to start it somewhere. So it started there. I said, pretend you got no money. And she just laughed and said, oh, you're so funny. I said, yeah.
We are back, Sam Seder, on the Majority Report on the phone. It's a pleasure to welcome to the program author, journalist, and historian Jack Kelly on his latest, The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Jack, welcome to the program.
Great to be with you, Sam.
And I want to get to, but you know, Eugene Debs obviously has been enjoying a bit of a resurgence. He's all over the place now, as to paraphrase the president in some respects, largely, I think, because of the moment. And he plays a big part in your book. But before we get to Debs, give us a sense. I mean, your book starts right around just before a major recession or depression, I guess, in the late 1800s. Give us a sense of what of the labor movement at that time. It's Reconstruction. We're a couple of decades out now from the Civil War, maybe a little bit less. What's the labor movement like at that time?
Well, it was kind of fragmented. It was uncertain as to what the status of labor was in the country. There had been unions, both small craft unions, so the Carpenters Union, and there had been larger organizations like what was called the Knights of Labor, which was a very large, very inclusive union. Nobody knew exactly what direction the labor movement was going to take, and nobody really knew whether it was legal to strike, whether it was legal to even be a member of a union. And all this was sort of up in the air. Eugene Debs had started out as an official of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Firemen, and those were the guys that shoveled the coal into the burner to keep the locomotive going. And he saw over the years, and he was involved with them for quite a long time, and he saw that these craft unions, the unions that were organized around a particular skill, were ineffective. The railroads were getting more and more, the corporations were getting larger and larger. They were becoming more and more monopolistic. And they used these small craft unions against each other, and were able to manipulate them. And Deb saw this need for a larger conglomeration of the workers themselves into what was then called an industrial union that would include everybody in the industry, and that would give them the clout. So that was really the origin of the of this conflict that broke out in 1904. And as you mentioned, the country was in the middle of the worst depression that it ever experienced. And the depression of the late 1890s has been eclipsed by the larger depression of the 1930s. But at the time, it was absolutely horrific, bottom dropping out of the country type of depression. It went on for almost 5 years.
All right, and before we get to George Pullman and the strike and how, in many ways, I guess like there were different players in our society who were sort of developing their roles in the context of a labor capital conflict. Tell us a little bit about Jacob Coxey. I found that really fascinating.
Yeah, that was it was really a symptom of that, how desperate people were in that that year of 1894, before the Pullman strike and Debs got going. Coxey was actually a businessman. He had the government was at the time was had absolutely no idea what to do about the Depression. There wasn't even really much in the way of theories as to how they should act to alleviate it, and there was no safety net. So Coxey had a very reasonable idea. It was why not hire the unemployed men, put them to work on the roads, what we would call infrastructure investment, and you would end up with people having jobs, and you would have a productive asset when you've got finished with improving the roads, which were in terrible shape at the time. The government didn't want to hear about that. He organized a group of unemployed men. They walked from his home in Ohio all the way down to Washington, D.C. to bring this to Congress. And that was the first March on Washington. Now it's become sort of a national institution as a form of protest, but he was the first one to actually bring it about. And it made the government so nervous that they handed out rifles to office workers at the Treasury Department, because they thought these guys were would break into the Treasury and loot the vaults there. And the movement was referred to as Coxey's Army, but it was in no sense an army. It was totally peaceful people that just wanted to be heard.
And did anything come of that? I mean, aside from the defensiveness, I mean, we should also say this is, you know, we're now, I guess, about 20 years out from the institution of an income tax, right, at this point. And I would imagine, like, all of these desires to have the federal government take a bigger role, particularly in the context of, like, a depression, start to generate some of this, I guess, impetus to raise more funds or to have more sort of dedicated funds, I guess.
Nothing really came of the Coxey movement, except for that sort of nervousness that it generated in the country. He was arrested for walking on the grass. There was actually a law saying that it was illegal to deliver a harangue on Capitol Hill, which was kind of an ironic law at the time. And his idea was really ahead of its time. It was more Keynesian this was before Keynes and the idea of stimulating the economy when it's depressed. But the Grover Cleveland, who was president then, was a devotee of the gold standard, and the hard money stance was exactly the opposite of what was needed during a depression, but he went on to exacerbate it. They did pass a income tax, but it was overturned by the Supreme Court, I think, in 1895. The Supreme Court in that era was very conservative and very backward-looking, and they ruled that sort of on a technicality that income tax was not constitutional. It was another, I think it was in 1913 before they actually passed a constitutional amendment that allowed the first income tax.
I should just put in parentheses for our libertarian friends who believe that the income tax is still illegal, because I think there were two states that supposedly did not have quorum for that amendment. But that's for another day. Let's talk about George Pullman and set Pullman up for us, because on some level, I mean, he's sort of like an early prototype of maybe this is too far of an analogy, but there's something Jeff Bezos-ish about him, and particularly when we're getting this sort of like Amazon campus in Queens now. But tell us what George Pullman about him.
That's an interesting parallel, because the one thing I would certainly say is they were both business geniuses. And Pullman had a great sense of what people wanted. He went into the railroad business at exactly the right time in the 1860s and developed sleeping cars. And the first transcontinental rail line opened in 1869. You could suddenly go from East Coast to West Coast in a week. But even traveling for a week on a coach car was uncomfortable. So he came up with these cars that can be converted into beds that were extremely luxurious. They had all the gewgaws that the Victorians loved, and they were fabulously successful. And he didn't sell them to the railroads, but he retained ownership and operated them on the railroads. All the money the people paid for the upgrade to a Pullman car went into George Pullman's pockets, and he became fabulously wealthy. To build the cars, he constructed what was at the time was one of the biggest factories in America, about 15 miles south of Chicago. And his idea was to get out of the center of the city, which, like many cities during the industrial era, Chicago had been clogged with tenements and squalor. And he thought that it would be better to build the factory outside the city. And to accompany it, he built a company town, which was seen as a model town. This was the way cities should be built in the future. It had neat little brick cottages for the workers, parks, playgrounds, schools, libraries, and it was right beside the factory. And that was sort of the origin of the of the dispute that came later, 20 years later, when he, or about 15 years later, when he, his workers went on strike against him.
Talk about the development of the strike, because I want to at one point bring in the question of race here, which is important, it seems to me, throughout this story. On some level, it runs parallel, and then there's a moment where it could intersect, I guess, or does it? I mean, the story of race seems to me to be intertwined throughout. The plight of black workers at that time could have been intertwined as well, but didn't. And that may have been sort of like the fatal flaw to this strike on some level. But tell us, the strike develops because people living in Pullman's company town, it's a fairly small, complaint, or would have been fairly small for Pullman to rectify. But he was very, it seems, rigid about, on principle. He doesn't want to in any way give a concession to the workers.
Yes, that's exactly correct. One of his neighbors said he was the most frigid, pompous autocrat I'd ever seen. And his personality did have a big effect on the whole thing. He responded quite reasonably to the slowdown by lowering, dropping the wages of his workers. But instead of also lowering the rents, which in general rents were going down because it was a depression, he kept the rents at the same level. So guys would work for 2 weeks, and they were paid every 2 weeks, and they would get a check for $3. And that was to bide you over for another 2 weeks and feed your family. This brought up a lot of the complaints that they already had about the model town, which was not really such a model. It was filled with company spies. There was no town government. It was all run by the company. There were these petty rules that they would make up and post around that you had to obey. And the workers were generally discontent. And when they were being squeezed between the rents and the lower wages, they decided to go on strike. The other angle that you're referring to, and I think it is important, I think it's just an illustration in a way that whenever you go back into American history, you're always tripping over the race question. George Pullman, partly as a Republican and a follower of Lincoln, he had hired freed slaves, almost all freed slaves, to work on his sleeper cars as servants. and that was, in a way, it was a benign act. It was trying to help them out. It was one of the few jobs that they could get on the railroads or anywhere else. But he had, his personality was such that he had to make money at everything. So one of the ways he made money off of them was he didn't pay them. They worked exclusively for tips at first, and then after a while they got they would get like $10 a month, and they had no opportunity to rise. They had only that one role as what was called porters. They were the Pullman porters. When the Pullman factory workers went on strike, they appealed to the American Railway Union, which was this big inclusive union that Eugene Debs had started just about a year earlier. That union happened to be having their convention in Chicago at exactly the same time that the strike broke out. And one of the questions at the convention was, should we allow black workers into the union? And Eugene Debs pleaded with them, the delegates from all the locals, please, you know, you have to, this is, the union had been founded on the idea of solidarity, including everyone in one big union. You can't draw the race line. Unfortunately, they voted by a very small margin. They voted to exclude blacks from the union. And as the strike unfolded and the union tried to help the Pullman workers by boycotting Pullman cars on the lines, it would have been much more effective if they could have had the Pullman porters on their side, because they were absolutely necessary for operating the Pullman cars. But instead, the black workers continued to work. They weren't allowed in the union. And the strike ultimately came to naught.
All right, let's talk about the role of the U.S. government, the federal government, and we should on some level, you know, also, I guess, the courts and the sort of the state and local. The attorney general at that time was a guy named Richard Olney, and he was a railroad attorney, but he was... Was he still actively an attorney for the railroads?
He was still an attorney for the railroads. He was a director of several railroads, and it was almost like being attorney general was like a sideline for him. And so his sympathies was, you know, he was supposed to be the chief officer of justice in the country, and instead he worked hand in hand with the railroads, they were very eager to break the strike and break the union, because they saw this industrial union as a pretty good threat to them, and so he worked hand in hand with them all through the strike, and appointed another railroad lawyer as the special U.S. attorney in Illinois to handle the day-to-day fight against the strike. So that was a major part of the reason that the workers lost, because they did stick together. They did shut down the railroads. They put enormous pressure on both the railroads and Pullman. But once the government got involved, they were up against more than they could handle.
Well, I mean, give us a sense of what that pushback looked like. I mean, you know, aside from injunctions, I mean, I guess it's, you know, this is one of those classic cases where the court does issue an injunction, but then, you know, then the question is, and what army? And it turns out basically the U.S. Army.
Yeah, the injunction really made the strike illegal, and not only just illegal in general terms, but individual acts of, if you didn't go to work, you were essentially breaking the law. You could be jailed without trial because you were in contempt of court. If you talked to somebody about the strike, you could be jailed for being in contempt of court. So that was a pretty powerful weapon against the strike. And Olney also convinced Grover Cleveland, the president then, to send in the U.S. Army that was a very sketchy, there was a very sketchy legal basis to that, because the Army was not supposed to be involved in any kind of law enforcement, as it is not, also not today. But the Army came in with artillery, cavalry, primarily in Chicago, but also in other cities out west, and were involved in putting down the strike.
And so to the extent that there was a, I mean, so the strike is put down, essentially the workers go back without, any type of relief, and particularly in the context of those rents, I guess.
Yeah. And they also had to sign a, what was called a yellow dog contract, which was a contract that said that they would never, ever again join a union. That was added on top of the.
All right. Well, then tell us, you know, what happens afterwards, because this is one of those examples of like a of, I don't want to say a good loss, but the value that can come out of a loss in a political fight.
Yeah, I think it's an interesting look into sort of the complexity of history. There was no real black and white. In a way, the outcome of the strike was paradoxical, because Eugene Debs lost the strike and went to jail, lost his court fight against the injunction, and had to go to jail for 6 months. And yet, when he came out of jail, he was welcomed back to Chicago by 100,000 supporters, and he was lionized. George Pullman won the strike, but he was widely reviled for his intransigence, and even a lot of his friends said, you know, if he'd been a little more flexible, he could have saved the country all the turmoil. And I didn't go into much to the turmoil that resulted from the strike, but it was so widespread, closing down railroads on which so many towns and cities were dependent. You know, the price of food went through the roof. There was several dozen people got shot dead. All that could have been saved if he'd just been a little more flexible and a little more human in his dealing with his employees, but he didn't see it that way. And the strike also gave an impetus to the progressive movement, which was coming along and came along a few years later around the turn of the century. And both railroad workers and workers in general received the benefit of legislation dealing with whether they had the legal right to unionize, whether the hours of work, the conditions of work, child labor, minimum wage, things like that began to be to come into play, a lot because of the shock that this strike had on the country and on wealthier people in particular. It was the type of insurrection that they were, you know, had nightmares about. And so that one of the results of the strike was the progressive era. A big strike, and I can go into in a minute, is its effect on Eugene Debs, because he changed his tune to a great extent because of his experience in the strike.
Well, yeah, let's talk about that, how that, what lessons he learned from this.
Well, he saw that if the government was going to come in on the side of capital, then it didn't do any good to just to organize labor, that you needed to change the government. And so he was one of those unusual characters who became more and more radical as he got older. For most people, it's sort of the opposite. You're radical in your youth and it sort of wise up as you get older. But Debs transformed this American Railway Union into what became the Socialist Party of America, and started on a career as a politician and ran for president of the United States five times as a socialist, and built up at least the beginnings of a socialist movement during that era. And never, of course, gained a lot of traction in America, but he was the great prophet of socialism.
What was it that, I mean, I just want to explore that dynamic where he has this because he clearly sees that a government that that weighs in on the side of capital, and this one was extremely corrupt, but we can see it in the context of things like Taft-Hartley puts its thumbs on the scale for management and capital in terms of legislation. But he sees what there is. Does he think that there is no? Just expand a little bit more on that realization he has about what he needs from government.
Well, yeah, I think he took the principles that he applied to labor organizing, which was this idea of solidarity, that if workers could express solidarity with each other and all join together, not fight amongst themselves. He took that idea and applied it in an even larger context of the country as a whole, that if the working class could all pull together and form a party and actively fight against the powers in the government, that it could bring about fundamental change. And there was a lot of very hopeful, utopian, you could say, ideas that society could be transformed, and this was the beginning of it. The reasons why it failed, I'd say, on the one hand, though socialism failed, the ideas that socialists were putting up at that time, such as government-sponsored old age pension or health care or unemployment insurance, did work their way into the political mainstream, but socialism as a creed never really got the traction that Debs had hoped it would, and he certainly worked as hard as he could to bring it about. And people loved to hear him speak, but they just didn't want to vote for him.
I mean, there's an obvious, you know, we hear a lot of people talk about this era as being the new Gilded Age. I don't know if, the sort of the wake of the financial crisis in 2008 and the Great Recession is analogous. But I mean, tell me what you see in terms of analogies and contrasts from that era and this one.
Well, I think that what you're saying is very true. That this, you know, this idea of we're in the new Gilded Age, lack of regulation of capitalism. That was true in the Gilded Age. That was really the main problem, is there was just no, the government didn't want to get involved in anything. They didn't really know exactly what to do. Today, we're in the opposite, we're moving towards increasing regulation of capitalism, and now we're sliding backwards. That under this administration, under the Congress, a lot of regulations, so just everyday regulations of business that keep them a little bit in line, are being dismantled. And the thing about capitalism that they realized back in the 1890s and turn of the century was that it had to be regulated. Capitalism just doesn't work. The corporate form doesn't work if it's not regulated by government. And so I think it's a ominous trend away from regulation. The government, I usually bring up this parallel of Richard Olney, is a lawyer for the railroads, director of railroads, and was serving as attorney general. Today we have Andrew Wheeler, who's a lawyer for coal companies, a director of lobbyist for coal companies, a climate change denier for coal companies, and he's now just this past week is appointed as a permanent head of the Environmental Protection Agency.
He gets his confirmation hearing starts maybe tomorrow or Thursday, I guess, or Wednesday rather.
It's going to be interesting, I hope.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I would also say Barr, for that matter, at least in terms of you know, the sort of the most prominent investigation that's going on in the Attorney General's office, is coming in as someone who thinks that that should not happen. So there are some parallels, I guess, in that respect. I guess we'll see what comes out of this. I mean, on some level, these events are lagging indicators or forward indicators. I mean, if we can see this, coming out of something like the financial crisis, and now the diminishment of union rights in the context of the Janus case and whatnot. The other thing that strikes me is the courts that basically the same Supreme Court that created these injunctions on these labor strikes was also a court that was almost at the exact same time in that same year, I think, in 1895 anyways, they were rolling back voting rights that had been passed during Reconstruction, and essentially allowing, I think it was Mississippi, to start to institute some form of poll tax and literacy tests.
You can mention Plessy versus Ferguson, which made Jim Crow the law of the land, was working its way up to that. At the very same time as the strike was working its way through the courts and would be decided by that same Supreme Court.
Well, I mean, what do you make of that? Is that just a coincidence? These type of reactionaries, you know, or is it because I can understand it to the extent that, like, oh, okay, we see this union is actually creating solidarity, cross race solidarity, or is the impetus the same, or is it like a twofer insofar as we can diminish the power of working people and black people simultaneously? I mean, But why is it these two things seem to be paired up?
Well, Sam, I'm not a big fan of conspiracy theories or even of just general theories that explain things. As I look at history and as I've tried to express in the book, there's so many coincidences and things that happen by happenstance. And effects of people's personalities that have nothing to do with some bigger scheme that they have in the back of their mind to impose on society, but just like George Pullman, he happened to be a very cold man. If he'd been a little smarter, he'd been, could have overcome his personal qualms and avoided the conflict. A lot of those things just come together in ways that are very unpredictable, and that's the big story of history to me. And I'm not really the person to explain any of the bigger meanings of how these things come to be, because I think a lot of it is happenstance. That being said, the trend, for example, one thing that I see today that's hopeful is that the rhetoric of Bernie Sanders and of the younger socialists, Ocasio-Cortez and Rashida Tlaib, their rhetoric goes back to Eugene Debs and has a lot of that optimism and urgency of Debs more so than Karl Marx. And I think that it's possible, it's hopeful, that it can gain some traction now. That Bernie Sanders' campaign in 2016 was quite remarkable when you look at the whole history of socialism, that right. An avowed socialist could have the support that he had. So in that sense, I'm cautiously hopeful, I'd say.
Jack Kelly, the book is The Edge of Anarchy, The Railroad Barons, The Gilded Age, and The Greatest Labor Uprising in America. Thanks so much for your time today. Really interesting chapter of American history.
Well, thank you, Sam. It's great to talk to you.
All right, folks, we're going to take a quick break. Oh, I should say, I mean, maybe this, you know, belongs to join this with. But on the program yesterday, the live show, we were talking about the fact that we're in now the longest shutdown, and people's checks are now being delayed, right? They get paid every 2 weeks, and there are contractors who will never get paid, will not not necessarily get back pay. Ostensibly, Congress will provide back pay for people. That does not diminish the anxiety and the stress that's caused, and obviously things like maybe interest. People need to take out loans to cover stuff and whatnot. I had cited a coming out of that 93, the second longest government shutdown in 93, a statistic about 25,000 government workers had still not received all of their back pay from that time. I got a correction that, and I thought that I had said it was a function of unpaid overtime and whatnot. But this came out of a lawsuit that under the Federal Labor Standards Act and some state labor standard acts, if an employer fails to pay wages due, an employee or class of those who successfully sue can recover the unpaid wages double damages. So, and attorney fees. Those payments have not been paid to those 25,000 workers from that 1993 case. I'm not convinced that there wasn't some overtime that's still due, but according to this audience member who was at the show, Shannon, that was not the case. But I stand corrected. The bind, as she writes, that I understand workers are in is that they are prohibited by law from striking. This came up yesterday in the conversation. Because I think they're considered essential workers. If they strike, they can be fired. If they keep working for no pay, they can be reasonably confident of retro pay and possibly double damages years in the future after a class action lawsuit is complete. And she does not appreciate that dynamic. I'm not going to. Well, she says that is crap. I mean, as opposed to, it's not too bad. She says, and I think this is sarcastic. I'm not deeply disappointed. The free swag wasn't awarded for the farthest traveling fan. Chicago. We had people who came from across the country. I got two beautifully knit hats that say Cedar to Sam Cedar 2020. That Myla and Saul are arguing over the second one.
They looked really good.
They were
incredible.
Folks were
very well made.
Very sweet, and we all had magnets that we were giving out to people who were traveled. That was, we didn't get all of them out. But perhaps future shows. We're looking into it. I mean, contemplating it. Maybe we'll do like a barnstorm on the West Coast, maybe a barnstorm on the East Coast, that type of thing. But we shall see. But just a reminder, this program exists because of its members. Members make this show possible day in, day out. And as a way of saying thank you, we give you extra content every day. So you can join the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. And for just a couple of bucks a week, maybe works out to 50 cents a show.
I think it was.
50
Didn't we
cents,
actually try to do the math once?
50, I think it I comes think it out 50 cents a show, which is about less than 20 cents an hour of content. That's pretty good.
I like the image of like you're just like feeding like dimes into an old jukebox.
That's
you
right.
Get the Majority Report.
Exactly.
You throw it on
that's
the biker
probably
bar.
Where
and
this
then all
will
of a sudden,
end.
And then you just hear, like, and the actuarial report said
how
otherwise.
Awesome would that be?
That would be amazing.
People should be.
So what'd you put on, friend?
The majority report.
Oh, all right.
All right. Is that that guy that debates libertarians?
Again, thank you to everybody who came to the show yesterday. It was a lot of fun. Today is Monday. Tomorrow is Tuesday. We're 2 weeks out now from the live Michael Brooks show. Is that right?
Yes. Very, very excited about it because it was like yesterday was so great and the people were so great. It just reminded me of how exciting it is that we're going to be doing this. We still have some tickets left, so come grab your tickets. The show is going to be a little bit different than a Tucker Carlson viewing party. We have a slightly
we played
different
a lot
emphasis.
Of Tucker Carlson.
But we're doing some pre-recorded sketches. Trevor Bolyeu is there. Mike Racine, Bhaskar Sankara, Lona Minkowski, of course. Matt said it was like the Coachella of progressive talk. So there you go. Or Glastonbury, we decided. Tomorrow night, Anna Kasparian and patreon.com/TMBS or stream on the YouTube channel. We have a video up on Tulsi Gabbard that's offended a lot of people.
Oh, there you go.
We got to figure that out, man. Can I go on this tangent for 1 second? I don't even hold with like, she's the worst person in the world, right? Like I'm not even coming from that place. I'm just coming from, if you're on the left, there's a lot of really obvious places of serious criticism and concern about her, and I don't understand the cult response to her.
Politics are dumb.
Not the best person to be left representing presidential or vice presidential candidate.
Not even remotely, and that's not even to me again, that's like descriptive. That's not even really the meat of the criticism. That's just like reality based on record.
Mike Cernovich is into her, though.
That's good.
That's a fucking anti-war coalition.
We'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow. Jack Posobiec is, too. These are two of my favorite guys.
was that intentional?
Bumblejack.
What is it? What is
Posobiec?
Well, how does he say his name?
Posobiec, right?
Posobiec?
No, but I'll go with Posobiec.
I don't know.
Bumblejack.
Yeah, exactly. Bumblejack. Jamie.
Bumblejack.
You guys, you're like on a recording spree.
Yeah. Yeah, after the live show last night, we headed back to the studio and laid down some hot tracks for the Antifada, and now I'm very tired, but I am excited about the things we are releasing. Today we put out a patrons only bonus called Real Poly Hours, in which we for now I'll leave it to our patrons to guess which spicy takes we have on polyamory. Is it bourgeois decadence that serves only to aggrandize our tech bro overlords?
Yes.
Or is it a totally normal and fine life choice that haters should STFU about?
No.
Find out on our patrons only bonus. Also,
defer to Stalin, right, Jamie?
No.
Defer to Stalin.
Oh, I mean, I don't know. You have to listen to find out what my opinion might be on polyamory and the colon tie stuff.
DTS.
Speaking of Stalin, we also recorded an episode last night about the amazing Netflix show called Trotsky. Have you guys heard of it?
No.
It's amazing. You can come for the revisionism, stay for the anti-Semitism. It's really, it's quite the piece of work. So
that tidying up show too, right? Isn't that the one where the Japanese author helps you tidy up? Is that the same thing?
Oh wait, the minimalism podcast.
Yeah, minimalism tidying cool. up. Show.
Wait, why would that be like Trotsky?
I don't know. It's the only other.
Is,
show.
It, is she anti-Semitic?
I don't speak
by
Japanese.
By the way, what
she could be
when yeah she goes.
I don't trust anyone who tells you to only have 30 books. Like no.
I do.
That's the bullshit right there. But yeah, this Trotsky show, it's a real piece of work. And we talk about it with our friend who is actually from the Soviet Union and lived his early years there. So that's pretty fun. And also, I wasn't even going to plug this, but it's very on topic for the interview that we did today. Sean tonight is recording a new edition of History is a Weapon with a very special guest. I won't spoil who it is yet, but he has a reputation for getting very angry And they're going to break down, using the immortal science of historical materialism, why socialism never caught on in the U.S. and why we never got a real labor party.
Is it Mike Francesca?
I'm not saying shit.
He got mad.
Matt.
Remember Mike Francesca?
I don't know who
I don't know
is.
What you're talking about. Literary Hangover coming out this week. We're doing House of Seven Gables. Topics covered is whether witchcraft was maybe a good thing. The witch trials, I should say. Whether the witch trials were actually good.
Very topical.
Is this a certain take that a certain deceased author had?
But yeah, it's relevant to the House of Seven Gables. Also, we'll talk about Jim Crow. The jumping Jim Crow dance. Have you ever heard about the actual cultural history of Jim Crow?
No.
So Jim Crow, we'll get into it, but if you can believe it, a white guy mimicked a cultural expression by black people and went into blackface, and he was jumping Jim Crow. It was a type of dance, and like a white guy made it.
I definitely believe that.
Yeah, so it's hard to believe, I know, but we'll go into that a little bit. A lot of different things we'll cover, so they'll look out for that this weekend. Literary Hangover.
All right, folks, see you in the fun half.
Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube. He's up there buggy whipping like...